Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 96, A Midsummer Night's Fair. Today we are joined by Ellie Dix, a game designer and owner of Dark Imp, as well as the author of the Board Game Family book. Thanks again for coming on the show. I'm super excited to talk with you.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. For anyone who doesn't already know you, I always start out with, like, how did you get into the industry, design some games?
As many game designers would say the same thing, I've been kind of indoctrinated into board games from quite a young age and playing a lot with my family, riffing on games and designing my own bits for games and getting rid of cards and putting new cards in and mashing games together. I also had a kind of a weird upbringing because my mum taught, well, this isn't that weird. But I suppose it's unusual because I got to do quite a bit of playtesting when I was young. My mum was taught maths to teachers who were training, to people who were training to become teachers. And one of the things she always got them to do was to make maths games. And I and my sister would be the testers. And we would go in and give feedback to these student teachers on their maths games. So I got used to the fact that you could create games early on and the sort of development process. But also my dad's sort of big into gamification of things, mainly because he gets quite bored very quickly. So he would make everything into a game, pulling random numbers out of the hat to determine where we went, you know, for a day out or even holiday with my mum. And computerizing things, randomizing things, and turning everything into a game. So I got used to these two sort of different kinds of things. Plus, they were always into odd games that most people didn't have. So we didn't just have mass market games in the family home. Even in the 70s and 80s, we had games that were quite unusual at the time. Now would be considered more hobby games. Then I suppose, how did I get into it proper? Well, I was a teacher and I was designing games for the classroom. I think after I became an adult and I did a lot of sort of holiday clubs. I did kids activity groups. I worked as a youth staff on a cruise ship. I did Camp America, camp counselling. And all of it was really game related. And so games were always sort of featured very heavily. And then when I became a teacher, I was teaching drama. I was creating games for the classroom. I was also teaching maths, teaching that through games. And it just sort of became a natural thing. In terms of actual sort of designing games for people to sit down and play at home, that evolved over much later. But it was sort of a natural evolution from the sorts of things I was doing in my work.
I feel like I have a lot of crossover. My dad's friend used to be a puzzle designer, so I got to playtest that when I was a little kid before knowing what that actually meant, which I always found super duper fun.
My parents gave me so many puzzles because I found it really hard to entertain myself, and TV was not then what it's like now, you know, and I didn't have a telly, you know, in my room. It was a family thing that we all sat around and watched, and I got very bored. And so I would get these logic puzzle books and I loved doing those. And actually, one of the other things I remember doing, my dad was a head teacher at a secondary school. And once a year, he used to create the timetable for the whole school. And he closed off our dining room and had this huge magnetic board with all these different magnets on and all these different colours relating to the different classes, the different teachers. And he would ban us from going in, but I was totally fascinated by it. And I would kind of creep in and look at this crazy organisational, you know, puzzle, basically, how you create the timetable for a whole school. And I loved it so much that that's what I used to do in my a lot in my spare time. I used to create timetables for fictional schools. I know that sounds really weird.
No, I love it. It's so funny. Yeah, people always ask me, like, Danielle, how do you do so much stuff? And I'm like, it really is. Like, my time management is a puzzle. It's what makes it fun and gets me able to do so many things. Oh, you're such a little nerd.
That's true. And I found myself doing exactly the same kind of things that my dad used to do when we were little. So I mentioned that he kind of generated these trips with random numbers. And I did exactly the same thing with my son the weekend before last. We kind of decided on a method of going, you know, we had a 24-hour window where we were going to go off. My son's 21. He's studying game design at university, actually. And we thought, right, we're going to go off for a random adventure. And we actually did it using polar coordinates. So we did an angle from where we are and a distance from where we are randomly. And we ended up going there. But we went and visited in England, we have these things that are brown signs. And if it's a brown sign, it's a place of interest. So we went to visit all the brown signs on the way. And it was a totally random trip. And then we tried to find a hotel, which did actually take quite a long time because there was some big event going on. So it was the slight downfall of the plan. But it's those sort of quirky things, that kind of randomness, that being open to, I don't know what's going to happen, let's just play and see, really, that gives me a lot of energy, that I get a lot of enjoyment from, and that excites me and kind of gives me ideas, I suppose.
I feel that. A lot of my inspiration comes from my little solo trips or like jumping into another country with very little planned. I've definitely had an issue with the whole hotel thing. I once shot over to Ireland. I did standby. I ended up not like in Dublin, but in Shannon. And then I like rented a car and started driving around. But I didn't start looking for a hotel until too late. So the closest hotel that was open, because apparently it was some holiday or something, was like 3-hour drive away. So I got there at like 1 a.m. So I was just up for easily over 24 hours. It was a mess, but you know, it was a good journey. A lot of adventure.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that creates memories, even if it can be a bit stressful at the time. But, you know, every hotel we went into said, why don't you just try Googling for hotels? And I'm like, I am not. But we were having a Google free trip where we were like, no, we're not doing that. We also navigate. I bought an atlas. I haven't had an atlas in about 10 years. I bought an atlas so that Alfie could navigate us there. I was like, no, we're doing it without Google. So we're just going on spec. We're going to drive until we find some hotels and see what happens. That was fun.
That's amazing. Oh my God. My brother used to get the new atlas every single year. He was such a geography nerd. It was so cute.
Oh, I love maps.
Well, this is amazing. I love this so much. But all right, let's switch back over to A Midsummer Night's Fair. For anyone who hasn't played this game, like, where did the inspiration come from?
It is very much inspired by sort of fairground games. Or I suppose the games that you might find at a theme park, not the rides, but the games.
Like the ring toss or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Those sorts of things. Hook a duck, ring toss, ball in a bucket. We have, I don't know if you know, coconut shy. Some of these things are very English, which is part of the reason that some of it has changed. Because coconut shy is some poles with coconuts balancing on them and you have to knock the coconut off the pole.
Oh, I've seen similar things. It's just not a coconut. It's like a ball.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. But, you know, I don't know why it's called a coconut shy. Anyway, so it was inspired by these sorts of games and the fact that I wanted to create something where you got the feeling of playing different mini games as part of the whole game.
Okay, so then how do you play the game?
Originally, I mean, do you want me to talk about how it started or do you want me to talk about what it's like now?
Yeah, let's do both. I mean, I love hearing about where it starts and then how it got to where it is now and like what development changes, playtest changes. We love all that.
So there's been quite a lot of evolution, although what's stayed absolutely the same is this sort of fairground theme with the mini games, and that you play lots of different games as you go through. Each player has a bunch of dice. In the published version, it's 6 dice. We started off with 10 per player. And you roll your dice in your own dice pool, and then you, on your turn, you're placing out a dice into a mini game. You don't roll it again. There are some games that require, for example, there's Test Your Strength, which you're going to win that game if you have the highest total on the dice that you put into that mini game. And then there's other games where you've got to have like most of the same number, or you're trying to get closest to a target number. There's some kind of traded dice that are rolled, and you're trying to hit the number, or you're trying to get closest to a number without going over. There's also a tug of war where you're trying to balance the two sides. So what you're doing is you're placing one of your dice, which is your color, into one of these mini games, and that's really all you're doing on your turn. And then the next player does exactly the same. So that's the idea, is that you're placing a dice out. In the original version, you could choose to place a dice or score a mini game when there's a certain number of dice within the game. And so you're trying to sort of hit a threshold of dice, and then you could choose to score the game. And when you scored a game, you would get a ticket, which would give you some power that you could use later in the game. That's evolved and changed so that now there's loads more tickets in the game and they're called mischief cards. The fairground has sort of changed into a kind of a fairground run by magical creatures. So there's a lot of pixies and fairies, and there's trolls and goblins hanging around running all these different kind of carnival stands. So there's definitely a feeling in the published version of this kind of magical creatures, and the artwork very much echoes that. They've done an amazing job with it. So now there are these sort of mischief cards instead of the original tickets. And with the mischief cards, you can have a lot. You can basically cause mischief. You can swap people's dice over. You can flip dice to a different number. You can add one or two. And you can do that with your own dice, with other people's dice, or with the trader dice. So there's a lot of chaos. And I should say, this is very much a family game. There is a lot of luck in the game. There's a lot of randomness in the game. It's very lightweight. It's definitely not particularly strategic. It's just a sort of fun family afternoon romp with a load of dice, basically. So as you're playing through the game, you start with 3 different mini games out. And as soon as one of those mini games gets scored, and these mini games are on different, they're on big cards, so giant cards, you flip the card over and discard it, and then you get a new mini game out. So every time one's scored, another game comes out. So the kinds of mini games you're playing as you go through change. If you win a mini game, you get to roll the special custom dice, the troll dice, into the box lid. And what you're trying to do is, so in the box lid, there's a sort of forest, magical forest printed. So there's artwork in the box lid. But there's also some numbers spread out across the box lid. You're going to kind of shoot your dice, throw it into the lid, but you can't have your hand over the box lid. So you've got to release some distance away from the box lid, and you get points according to the number on the top of the die. And if the die is sitting on a number in the box lid, you get that value as well. If you roll the troll on the dice, or if you roll it into the dragon's lair, which is right into the middle of the box lid, you get nothing. So there's this kind of skill / luck element of how much could I score here. I could score 12, but I could score 0. So you get points for being second in the game, and that's an absolutely definite 3 points. But you could decide to try and win the game, and then you might get more than that, or you might get less than that. So it's a bit of a gamble.
Yeah, I love the artwork on the inside of the box and for the entire game. It looks so cute.
It's interesting because that sort of rolling has changed very much during the game. It started off with I don't know if you know what a helter skelter is. It's again a very English thing. It's like a big wooden slide. Some people know it because of the Beatles album Helter Skelter. But it's like a an old-fashioned wooden tower, but it's usually circular, painted red and white stripes or spirals.
Oh, yes, yes, of course I know what this is. Yes, okay. Thank you for describing it.
Okay, and then you have like a ladder up the middle, and then around the outside there's a spiral wooden slide, and you sit on top of a sack and you slide down the spiral outside, helter skelter. So I made this sort of helter skelter style dice tower where you could choose, instead of putting dice into a mini game, to put it in top of the helter skelter, and then there was a sort of barrier that you could pull out at the end of the game, and all of the dice inside the dice tower would then be released, and they'd come down the chute and they would land on a sort of strip, and it's exactly worked in the same way as the current, you know, as the published version, where you kind of roll a dice into the box lid, you get the total on the dice and you get the total on the track, but it was all happening at the end of the game. And it was, you know, you're losing dice into the dice tower, and it was one big moment, but perhaps at the expense of the fact that people would like that to happen more often. There was also quite a few versions where with a dice slide, so you're sliding it rather than rolling it in, just a piece of punch board folded in half, which you would hold. And you had to hold it away from the box and you would just roll the dice down it. I also did a whole version, because there was a lot of discussion with Game Right about the number of dice we need, because there's quite a lot of dice. Now there's six, we're down to six per player. But we went through a version where we used counters. So, and we had numbers on the counters. So one number on the front, the other, another number on the back. And you, when you were pulling out, everybody have the same set of counters, but you would have to sort of flip them, and whatever side they landed on would be the number for that. And then you would roll these down the slide into the box lid, or, you know, onto the area where you could score points. So that changed as well. And actually, I quite like that mechanism with these counters having different numbers on different sides as a much cheaper version of dice. You know, you could have a bunch of these counters and you're flipping them all, or you're throwing them all up, or you're just chucking them down on the table, and you get a good range of numbers, but there's only two options. And I think that's quite, I might come back to that and revisit that as a component, as a mechanic, because it gives quite a lot of nice randomization without having the huge cost of the dice. But eventually we came back to dice because dice are nice. So, and they do look beautiful. They look like sweets, really, in this version. They're very pretty.
And so were there any other changes that maybe you didn't do, but it was more the publisher? Also, how did you get it with Game Right?
So I kind of, there was quite a long period from kind of conception to getting it signed. I mean, a couple of years. And I was sort of first pitching it, but very loosely. So I was self-publishing games up until 2021. And I started creating this game with a sense that I might self-publish it. And then decided against it when I decided I wasn't going to do any more self-publishing. And then at that point, I had like zero contacts in terms of publishing contacts. I hadn't done any pitching. So this was one of the first games I decided to pitch to other people. And so I had to really build up my network and work out how to do that. And Mojo Pitch is where I have made most of my kind of mass market contacts. And I've now been for the last 4 years to the Mojo Pitch, which is great. And that's where I met Ben Rathbone from Buffalo for the first time. So that's how it got with Buffalo, through a pitch at Mojo Pitch. But there was still quite a long period after I pitched it to when they signed it. He said he was interested in the meeting. He followed up really quickly afterwards and was always interested. And there was just a lot of back and forth with getting it to the right kind of game for them. Getting it so that some companies, they will see a game and think, oh, well, we'll sign it and then we'll do all the development in-house. And some companies will see it and then there's, you know, a lot of development beforehand. And that's the way that we did with this game. I was a bit of an unknown quantity, I think, you know. And so it's nice to do that development together, but outside of contract. And then when they, you know, when we got it to a place that they were happy with, they signed it. So it was about probably 10 months after pitching to the point at which it was signed. And then nothing changed after that because they were happy. So, yeah.
That's so cool. So how long do you think it took from that like initial inspiration of trying to make a game based off of like the Fairground games to it actually coming out where people can buy it? Gen Con, which is where my voice is currently a little groggy.
Yeah, so it's just been released at Gen Con. So that's like, I don't know, late July 2024. And it was conceived about just over 3 years ago. So from the initial ideas to coming out, it's been 3 years.
So what is your favorite mini game of all the games inside of it?
Well, so one of the things I really like about the mini games is that some of them work for people that love different kinds of things. And you know, so for example, my husband isn't a gamer. He doesn't really like the strategy side of things. He likes randomness. He doesn't know. He likes to be surprised. So he would say, like a game where you don't know what the trader's dice is going to be and you have to match as many, you know, have as many matches to that as you can. So you're putting in dice not knowing what dice are going to win. So I wanted to have games in there because it's very much targeted at families. I wanted to have games in there that would suit people that want a surprise or that want more randomness. And then I also wanted to have ones that require a bit more strategy. So I really love the tug of war one, where in that game, you have to keep the two sides of the line balanced. So if you see that there's two dice on one end of the line, but only one on the other end of the line, you have to add it to the end that only has one dice. So there's a little bit of a rule there in that game that some of the, you know, all of the other games don't really have. But you're trying to have the highest value on the winning side. So you have to spread out your dice, or you're trying to work out which side is going to win. But of course, people create mischief with the dice. So you can maybe hoard the cards that you want to try and create a situation where you're definitely going to win. But I think that one's really fun.
I love that. It's really cool that you're thinking about what is the audience for this game. When you were talking with Buffalo, did you know that it was going to end up with Game Right over Buffalo?
I didn't know until, I don't know when I found that out, actually.
Were you excited?
Yeah, I mean, complete. Who doesn't want to win?
I mean, it's also been my dream, so curious, but cool.
It's very cool. It's very exciting. But also, you know, Buffalo is their sort of, you know, even more mass market, I guess, is their kind of even more mass market wing. And Game Right is the line that we would know more as hobby gamers, because it sort of sits over the two a little bit more, I think. So, but, you know, yeah, it's so cool. I'm really excited by it.
Did it always have this name, or did it have a different name and theme?
So my original name was Bonza. Bonza doesn't mean anything, but I had all these different sort of fairground fonts that I was using for the different mini games. And I was looking for a name that had a sort of feeling of Bonza, you've won. You know, like a winning exclamation that you could have, and that would look kind of cool on a box in my mind when I was having this sort of fairground idea. And when Ben was pitching it internally at Buffalo, there was a lot of comments about, but what does Bonza mean? Like, what is this? Why has it got this stupid name on it? So yeah, they didn't get it. They didn't really like it. And it, you know, their name, Midsummer Night's Fair, just fits very nicely in with the fairy sort of magical creatures theme. I think the whole naming of a prototype is so interesting. And I've been thinking about it loads recently. I've just written an article about this on my blog. Because my assumption as a hobby gamer, very much involved in the hobby game world before I started to learn about mass market games, was that, you know, in doing a lot of playtesting with people who are making games for hobby publishers, was that the name doesn't really matter. You know, you name your prototype, but who cares what it's named?
Oh, yeah. I think it needs a good name because publishers are lazy, and the nicest way of saying they're lazy. Sometimes they don't see the vision.
Yeah. But I think what I've been asking a lot of people about this recently, and I think with hobby, sometimes doesn't matter. Like, they're going to change the name. With mass market, it seems to matter a whole lot more.
Well, that's because they're like signing it as a product more than they're signing it as a game versus hobby.
Exactly. And I've spoken to a lot of publishers and they'll say, oh yeah, a good name is going to sell this game. And it's just surprised me because I think there are a lot of game designers who don't think very hard about the name of their prototype, me included. And now I'm trying to reevaluate that and give it, make it more important because I've seen in the last, you know, even just the last 3 months with Mojo and a lot of pitching that I've done, that there's been a lot of comments about names. And so it's kind of shone a light on it a bit for me that it is an important thing and it deserves my attention. And okay, if you've got an okay name, it might not make any difference. But if you've got a great name, it could sell it. So you might as well have a great name if you can think of one. So now I've just got all these different games I'm thinking of renaming. And just like, you know, sitting around, scratching my head, trying to get inspiration for cool game names.
There you go. I mean, you could be like Emma Larkin, who came up with a bunch of different names and then decided to make like Abandon All Artichokes because of the name.
Well, I think, you know, I've been doing that as well. I've made games that are kind of inspired by names. But the key there is to check whether anyone else has made a game with that name before.
Yeah, I got obsessed with the name like Poor Decisions. And I was like, oh, this should be a drinking game. And then I was like, oh, there's a game with this name. Damn it. Oh, well. So for this design in particular, what was your favorite and your least favorite part of it? Like the whole process?
I think I always enjoy after I've got the first prototype. Like, sometimes it's exciting to map out those ideas that you're, you know, the very, you know, initial ideas in a notebook or whatever. But I always feel slightly stressed about it until I have a first prototype. And it doesn't matter how rubbish the first prototype is. But then I feel like I've got something that I can then change and modify and develop. And so I feel like, after I had the first prototype, that bit was really fun. You know, working out which mini games were good, working out which mini games were awful, doing a load of research into different fairground games and trying to come up with, you know, new things that you can do with dice because, you know, it's, as I said, very simple thing. We didn't want lots of difficult calculations or anything. I didn't want lots of difficult calculations or anything like that. And then I think probably the worst bit is, oh, okay, I finished it, or at least finished it to the point at which I think I can pitch it, right? So, you know, what is a finished game? But I would say, you know, I've got enough of this game and it's in a good enough state to be able to communicate to publishers what the essence of it is, you know, what the hook is. And if they like it, then we can do development work on it. So I would say that the most boring bit is probably, you know, doing the marketing for that, you know, creating the sell sheets and the videos and the things that you kind of put off and you have to make sure you do them. That's not really it's part of game design, though it's not game design itself. But it's definitely part of the job of a game designer. And then I had this influx of really cool stuff again when I got the views from Buffalo, you know, from Ben and his team about, you know, their feedback, what we like, what we're not that keen on, what we want more of. And that gave me direction to do more developments and do more testing. And I got back into it and they got really excited. And that excitement spilled over, you know, and it re-enthused me about the game, which was great.
And then what about on the flip side of it?
You mean the worst stuff other than having to create the sell sheets and stuff?
I mean, like, that is a thing that you kind of have to do. I would prefer something a little more specific to this design. Dig a little deeper.
In terms of the, I mean, I think that, you know, I loved that Helter Skelter. I thought it was a really cool moment at the end of the game with this kind of big reveal. I found it quite difficult to take it out, a little bit disappointing to take it out. And then I felt flat about, well, if I don't have this big component that makes it look like a fairground, the whole thing, it was the centerpiece that made everything look like a fairground. How am I going to get back that sense of excitement and that sense of physicality that you get from the game? And so when I had taken that out, and before we had all the kind of dice slides or throwing in, you know, the kind of throwing into the box, which developed this, all this skill, it felt like it was a bit flat. And I didn't like that bit.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see that, because it sounded pretty much like that was the thing that you were super interested in as far as the game components went. Plus also, like, if you more are on the hobby side, having that one cool dice tower, that one interesting component can really make a game, or at least like the marketing of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. But it didn't, you know, on reflection, it didn't really stand up to, you know, in terms of the, you know, it wasn't critical to the game. And in fact, it was ending up being slightly frustrating. So it wasn't pulling its weight as a game component. I wanted it to be in the middle, and I want it to be involved and central. And it wasn't really central to the design of the game. It was more of an add-on. So it was a good decision to remove it. But there was definitely a time at which I felt sort of, I mean, bereft is probably an overstatement in from an emotional sense, but I felt a sense of, you know, the way I felt about the game dipped a bit then at that moment. And, you know, you always have these things when you're working with a publisher. There's always something that you were inspired by, or that was critical to the design in the first place. It was part of the original inspiration, or something that you really loved, or you felt very, really proud of, or something that created some really cool moments in playtesting early on. And you thought at that time, I've got a game here, and it's because of that one thing. And then when you've got someone completely independent looking at it and judging it and giving their opinion on it, it's harder it's hard to deal with the reality of the situation. They were completely right. Of course they were right. It needed to be removed. It needed to be replaced with something that was more integrated. And it's a normal thing for someone else to come along later on and say, yeah, but that one thing, it doesn't matter if that was the original inspiration, that's got to come out.
I think that's a really hard thing for designers to like be okay with, but very well spoken. I think that's awesome. And do you have any advice for any like designers, especially maybe someone who went into things not having those connections, especially how you talked about networking through Mojo?
I mean, gosh, you could talk all day about advice for designers, but I just want to say, you know, it's thanks to the design community that I feel in a position where I can offer any kind of advice to anyone else, because I've been on the receiving end so often. You know, if you can get yourself to Mojo or something like it, or a virtual event, it is hugely helpful from an experience point of view. Even if you, you know, kind of go, I suppose I would say with pitching, what's your victory condition? Set your victory condition when you go into the pitch, because if your victory condition is to walk out of there with a signed game, you're going to be really disappointed almost all the time. I mean, I've never walked into a pitch and had it signed or a promise to sign on during that pitch meeting. Some people have, I know, but I've never had that. And it's quite rare, I think. So if that's your kind of victory condition about whether it was worth going today to go to that pitch, then you're going to be disappointed. So reframe the meeting. You know, what do you want out of this meeting? Do you want, you know, experience in pitching? Do you just want to have an opportunity to pitch your game? Do you want to establish a relationship with this publisher? Do you want to get to the point where you feel like you can contact them again and pitch something else to them? Do you want to feel like you've learnt something else about this publisher and what they're looking for that you can't tell from their website or from their very basic wish list that you may have been given, depending on where you're pitching to them? You know, for me, it's always about that relationship. I do not go into any pitch meeting expecting to sign anything. In fact, I never expect to sign anything at all, which is why it's so lovely when it happens. And I read this brilliant thing, which is a sales book. I can't remember where it came from. I think it was a sales book or a sales podcast or something, like a business thing, not a game thing. There was a piece of advice in that, which was set a target for how many like no's you're going to get or how many failures you're going to have. And so, you know, maybe your target for the year is 100 no's, right? And okay, so why set a target for no's rather than yeses? You know, people that have said no to your games, because that's something you can actually control. You just do more pitches. If you're setting a target for no's, then you're winning even if you're not getting games signed, because you're doing more and more pitches. And the more pitches you do, the more likely you are to sign a game, not just because it's a numbers game and you have to pitch a game to lots of people often before it lands with the right person, but also because you're getting experience at doing, you're getting better at knowing what people want, so you're choosing what kinds of things you're showing them. You're getting better feedback. You know what's going to land and what's not going to land. And so the more no's you get, ultimately the more yeses you're going to get, but you can't really control the yeses, so start to control the no's. So it's that sort of, okay, well, how are you going to make sure that when you go into a pitch meeting or when you come out of a pitch meeting, you feel like you've done what you wanted to do? I think that kind of change in attitude is super helpful to me, because if you focus always on needing a yes, you're in a constant state of rejection, and that's no fun. Nobody wants to be like that. So just reframe it. I know it's hard to do, but you know, it works, I think.
Oh my God, no, I mean, that's amazing advice. I always joke to people who meet me that I'm a master of rejection, because same to you, I also expect rejection at every meeting. But my goal has always been, okay, I want a publisher to want to reject me again. Like, I want them to want to talk to me again. Because, like, I don't think designers always see that they're pitching themselves on top of their designs.
Exactly. And so part of what I try to do is I go into a pitch meeting and I want them to remember me. I want to do something or say something, or just through my personality or through anything, something that happens in that meeting, I want them to remember me, so that next time I see them, they're not going to be struggling to try and remember who I am or what I've shown them in the past. So it might be that I've got a party game and I'm playing it with them. You know, if I can get them to, you know, stand up and pretend to be a hippo with a, you know, who's trying to draw something, or, you know, if I can get them to to squawk like a bird whilst crawling around on the floor or something, they're going to remember me. I mean, it might not be that they're going to sign that game, but they're going to remember the meeting. They're going to have had fun. They're going to, it's really about, how do you get to be a person that they know they can work with, that they're going to want to see, that they know has good ideas. So that, I mean, that's a really interesting thing, that even if you don't show them things that they're ultimately signing, you're showing them things that they appreciate are good game ideas. So they think you're a good game designer, even if they don't take anything. And so you are cementing that sort of perception of you every time you go in there. I've had offers of work through going and pitching when they haven't signed anything with me, but they've wanted me to work on stuff for them. So, you know, it's about your persona, your experience, your personality and your enthusiasm for game design. That says a lot. You know, you're selling yourself. You're absolutely right.
No, I've had the same thing happen where they're like, oh, we've seen you make all these awesome party games. We're stuck on this party game. We need your help developing. Can you do it? And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, because it really is. It's like a toolbox showing all the different mechanics and how you can work with stuff and how you problem solve and how you even answer their questions. When someone asks you, how'd you come up with this? Or like, what changes did you make? Or like, what did you find most difficult about this design? It's like being able to vocalize those things is huge, because it means you're really thinking through the process, and publishers love that.
And I think the other thing that, and this is related, but different, is that when you are, so if you're making a video, I when I make videos, I make sure my face is on the video, that I'm on the video, that I'm showing the game on the table, but I'm also doing half of the video to camera. Because when you are, you know, when you pitched a game to a company, they're taking it back into their business and they're showing the rest of the team. They have to pitch it internally. It's not the person that you pitch to is not going to be the only person who's involved in the decision making. So now, if you can leave them with an asset that not only explains the game because you can pitch it, but also conveys your enthusiasm and shows what kind of person you are and makes it look like you're a person that they want to work with, then that's you marketing yourself within the company afterwards as well. And that goes a long way, I think.
No, I definitely agree, because it's basically a first impression via video. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I do my videos very cheap and dirty. Just like, here's an iPhone, set it up. I have a friend, I shouldn't even say set up. I hand it to my friend and say, can you video? And then I do like one or two takes. But that's also because it takes a lot of time. I'd prefer to spend my time on designing.
That's what I do too, though.
Oh, good. Yeah. See?
Yeah.
And then there's some studios that are crazy good.
Oh, no. I'm spending zero money on it. I'm spending very little time. I am, the only thing I do is I do write a script, because I feel if I don't do that, I'm just going to waffle. And my 2 minutes ends up as 4 minutes, and nobody wants that. So I write a script and then I follow the script and I work out which bits I'm doing to camera and which bits I'm not. But it's all on my phone and it takes about 2 hours from start to finish, including editing. So it's not like a big, you know, song and dance number that's professionally produced, but I put some thought into it. But I think it's just that small thing of not just showing your hands and the game on the camera, but also showing your face and making sure you're performing, because you're selling yourself.
True. You are making me feel lazy, though. I literally do one shot and I do not edit. It's so bad.
But it probably isn't. You're probably really good at it. You know, for us mere mortals, if I could never send anything that I hadn't edited off, because it would come across as absolute rubbish. You're very good at, you know, you're very good at, you know, demoing, and you're very used to it. And that's different from a lot of people. You know, if you've got that skill where you can just do it and you can do it once, then brilliant. Why would you do it more than once? But if for me, and probably for a lot of other people, I wouldn't come across as I want to come across. So I'm not spending a lot of time. I'm spending no money, but I am doing a little bit of editing.
That's totally fair. Well then, what other projects should people be looking out for from you?
Well, I've got a few games coming out. So I've got a game with Ginger Fox that's coming out called Top Secret Briefs, which is a deduction game where you're trying to guess each other's underpants, and you have underpants in a little, they've done these really groovy little sleeves where you're putting in a type of underpant and on a sort of plastic card, see-through card, and then behind it is the pattern for the underpants, and you keep that secret and you're then trying to deduce what other people's pants are. And I've got a game called The Jane Austen Game coming out with Lawrence King Publishing in September. And that's it's a big box. It's a deck building game where you're playing Jane Austen. You're playing one of Jane Austen's heroines, and your deck is your acquaintances, and you go off to different places and meet different people and you gather the cards. And then you go off to balls where you meet the suitors and they come into your deck, and you go through your deck, and different cards that come out give you different restrictions or benefits, and you're trying to find the perfect match or become a woman of independent mind. So that's coming out. I've got a couple of other games that I'm really excited about. One that's coming out with Osprey actually it's probably 26, and one that's coming out with Buffalo, which will be late next year, which is very cool, but I can't really talk too much about that one.
Fair enough. Sounds like you got a lot coming out, though. That's exciting.
Yeah, there's quite a few things coming out. It's good. It's exciting. Yeah.
Sweet. All right. Well, for my last question, unrelated to anything we've talked about, if you could have designed a game that you weren't the designer of, which would it be?
It is a hard question. I think probably Patchwork, because it feels like it does all the things I like to do. You know, it's got this wonderful sort of polyomino tessellation thing going on where you're managing your own board. And then there's also the more powerful the piece, the further on the track you're moving. And so it will take you longer to have your turn again. It's just that it seems to be so beautifully balanced and so tense and so tight. And each time you play, you almost need a sort of different strategy, because you have to bear in mind what the strategy of the other player is and be responsive, but you also need to be proactive. It's just great. I just love the kind of the currency of the buttons and how they interact with the gameplay. I think it's one of those classics that you always, whenever I play, I was like, oh, I'd love to have designed this.
I want to own the Halloween version. That's the one I want.
Oh, I haven't even seen the Halloween version.
I know, I don't know if it's in, maybe it's not in print anymore, but I always get jealous when I see someone with it, because I only ever see the 4th of July version and the Valentine's version. I'm like, I don't really care about those. But no, it's a great game.
You need to search some bring and buy sales, or some, you know, go around bribing people at conventions and see it with.
Nah, everyone else can enjoy it. It's fine. It's also like the Batman love letter. That's the one I want. It's just someday the cards will align. I'll find it. It's like not something I need, but it's something that if it happens, I'd be very happy.
Yes. Yes. I get that.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And thanks for everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 96, A Midsummer Night's Fair. And thanks again, Ellie. For anyone trying to find you online, can you tell me how to do that?
Yeah, so my website's thedarkimp.com. I'm on Twitter at Ellie Dix Tweets. Dix is D-I-X. And I'm on LinkedIn, Ellie Dix. And you can look at my blog, which is on the website. Lots of game design stuff on there.
And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me, just look at any of the social media things except TikTok, because they took my handle, which is Token Gamer, and that's G-A-Y-M-E-R. Thanks for being on the show. This was awesome.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.